U.S. President Joe Biden signs 17 executive orders just hours after taking office, dismantling decisions made by his predecessor, Donald Trump. The EU foreign policy chief warns the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is at a critical juncture, urging the U.S. to return to the agreement. Also coming up, thousands of Yemenis take to the streets in Sana'a to protest the U.S. decision to designate the country's Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the reigning capital, Tehran. It's great to have you with us. Our top story this hour, U.S. President Joe Biden has signed 17 executive orders to undo Donald Trump's policies hours after taking office. The orders target the former president's policies on immigration, climate change, racial equity, and the handling of the coronavirus pandemic. The actions initiate the process of the United States rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, and include the revocation of the presidential permit granted for a controversial oil pipeline. In another order, Biden ended a travel ban Trump put in place on some Muslim-majority countries. The new president has also made compulsory wearing masks in all federal buildings and land. The president's move comes following his inaugural address in Washington, D.C.
We'll press forward with speed and urgency, for we have much to do in this winter of peril and significant possibilities. Much to repair, much to restore, much to heal, much to build, and much to gain. Few people in our nation's history have been more challenged or found a time more challenging or difficult than the time we're in now.
In his inaugural address at the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., Biden expressed concerns over the rise in political extremism, white supremacy, and domestic terrorism. He pledged to be a president for all Americans and said he would seek unity. Biden takes office at a moment of profound challenges he is facing at home and abroad. The signing-in ceremony ended Donald Trump's turbulent 4 years in office. However, at a farewell speech at a military base, Trump defended his much-criticized policy, saying his term was incredible and that his administration accomplished a lot.
What we've done has been amazing by any standard. We rebuilt the United States military. We created a new force called Space Force. That in itself would be a major achievement for a regular administration. We were not a regular administration.
Trump also vowed to stay in the spotlight, promising his supporters he will be back in some form. The outgoing president did not explicitly concede the election, but wished the new administration great luck and great success. However, he skipped the inauguration of successor Biden in an extraordinary break with tradition. Ramima Zahari says Islamophobia and Iranophobia reached an unprecedented level under the Trump administration.
State-sponsored campaign of Islamophobia and Iranophobia was, you know, it reached unprecedented levels under Trump, and it's something that, you know, is totally inexcusable. And for Biden to continue this would be equally inexcusable. However, I can, you know, report that it's not sure that he's going to lift the travel ban on Iran. There are conflicting reports, and they're saying that he's going to lift the ban today or tomorrow. They said, you know, he promised on his first day in office. It's on some countries, or some Muslim countries, and some other people are saying it's he's going to lift the ban on all Muslim countries. Unfortunately, I think that if there is one Muslim-majority country that is left out, it's going to be Iran.
And Democrats seize control of the U.S. Senate as new Vice President Kamala Harris swears in three senators just hours after taking office. John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock won the Georgia runoff elections earlier this month, wresting two seats from Republicans. Senator Alex Padilla from California also took Kamala Harris's seat. Both Democrats and Republicans now hold 50 seats in the Congress's upper chamber. but the vice president's vote can break the tie in favor of the Democrats. The two chambers of Congress are now controlled by Democrats, a development which is expected to help President Joe Biden enforce his policies. The U.S. COVID-19 death toll has surpassed the total American military fatalities from World War II. The Johns Hopkins University reported that nearly 406,000 people have died from the disease caused by the new coronavirus in the United States. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, the total number of combat and non-combat deaths in the Second World War was almost 405,400. The U.S. is the worst-hit country in the world by the virus, with more than 24.4 million cases. CovI-Iran, Iran's first COVID vaccine, is making headways and its human trials are inching closer to the final stage. However, this vaccine has now become targeted by the U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalani reports.
Iranian COVID vaccine inches closer to the market. 1 month has passed since the volunteers got their first injection of the CovI-Iran vaccine, and now they receive the second jab. CovI-Iran is currently the only viable Iranian vaccine that has made its way to human trials. The local vaccine uses a coronavirus that is weakened or killed by chemicals, similar to how polio immunization works. CovI-Iran is expected to inoculate 10,000 volunteers on the first phase of its human trials.
So far, 21 volunteers have received the first jabs and 7 others have got the second shot. Next week, we'll vaccinate 14 other volunteers. We hope that in 1 month and a half, we will wrap up the first phase of human trials and wait for the health officials to assess the results and give us the approval to start the second phase on a larger number of volunteers.
The new headways come as the U.S. has imposed fresh sanctions on the entity responsible for developing Iranian vaccines. The executive headquarters of Imam Khomeini's directive is now on the sanction list of the U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control. On top of it is its head, Mohammad Mokhber, whose daughter was the first to volunteer for the trial of the Iranian vaccine.
The development of the local vaccine is advancing as the U.S. is putting an all-out effort to hinder Iran's fight against the coronavirus. Rights activists have time and again called on the U.S. to exempt health items from the list of its sanctions against our nation, but to no avail. But despite all this hostility, our experts have managed to make progress in the development of vaccines.
Came days after leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, ordered a ban on the purchase of American and British vaccines, calling them unreliable. Iran had intended to buy 16 million doses of foreign vaccines to start inoculating its citizens before its own vaccines hit the market. But officials say the U.S. has been putting roadblocks on Iran's import of vaccines by refusing to exempt humanitarian supplies from the list of its anti-Iran sanctions.
This is not the first time the U.S. targets Iran's health sector, once by banning foreign vaccines and now by slapping sanctions on the pioneers of Iranian vaccines. But health officials say Iranian vaccines are immune to any foreign pressures, since they're 100% indigenous. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has reiterated his country's opposition to fresh talks with the U.S. over the 2015 nuclear deal.
There is no need for negotiations at all. The U.S. government has broken the law and breached its commitments. No one can hold talks for implementing their own commitments.
Zarif said if the U.S. lifts sanctions and implements its commitments under the deal, Iran will also return to the full compliance with the agreement. Earlier, the EU foreign policy chief called on the U.S. to return to the Iran nuclear deal and stop its policy of sanctions against Tehran.
There is a deal, and the deal had a nuclear side and an economic side. The Iranians are ready to go back to the full commitment, fulfillment of their commitments, if we, the other part of the deal, the Western world, fulfills also our commitments. And for that, we need the Americans to go back to the agreement, or at least to stop threatening with sanctions to everybody who participates in the economic relationship with Iran.
Borrell, in a letter to EU foreign ministers, also warned that the agreement is at a critical juncture. The United States withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. A year later, Tehran began reducing its commitments. It said the measures were in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to make up for Washington's pullout and sanctions. Iran has time and again said the measures are reversible if its economic interests are safeguarded as enshrined in the nuclear deal. Elsewhere, the United Arab Emirates has reportedly signed a deal with the US for 50 F-35 fighter jets, despite concerns about the Arab country's involvement in a deadly and devastating war on Yemen. Reports said that the agreement was signed about an hour before President Joe Biden was sworn into office. The UAE also signed a separate agreement to buy up to 18 armed drones. However, the new US president has said he will re-examine the agreement. The administration of former President Donald Trump had approved $23 billion in stealth-capable F-35 jets, Reaper drones, and other weapons to its Persian Gulf ally after it agreed to recognize Israel. The UAE is a member of the Saudi-led coalition that has been engaged in the years-long war on Yemen, which faces the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And supporters of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement have held a demonstration in the capital Sana'a against the U.S. decision to designate the group as a terrorist organization. The movement said in a statement that it is, quote, ready to take all necessary measures against any hostile act. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's administration announced the move on January the 11th. The United Nations and aid groups have warned that the designation risks worsening an already dire humanitarian crisis in the country. Yemen's war has killed tens of thousands, displaced millions, and according to the UN, left 16 million on the brink of famine.
Ansarullah Political Bureau has issued a statement to condemn the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist group. The statement was issued after the measure came into effect on January 19th, the last day of President Donald Trump in the office. In its statement, the movement has underlined the atrocity of the U.S. against the nations resisting its adventurous policies, including Yemen. The statement says the blacklisting of Ansarullah movement reveals that the U.S. plays a key role in Saudi-imposed war against Yemen. It calls the U.S. the major enemy of the Yemeni nation.
The American decision and designation was not surprising to us, as it came at the culmination of the U.S. hostilities against the Yemenis, ongoing on for 6 years by two succeeding American administrations. The American administration is the one who is committing acts of terrorism against the Yemenis, and if it reflects negatively on the Yemeni people, there will certainly be a response determined by the leadership.
The U.S. move has also sparked rage among the Yemeni academics and students, who voiced their anger in a protest organized by Sana'a University. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations who have not bowed to Washington's desires.
The Yemeni people of all groups, especially the academics, stand against this classification and they stand with Ansarullah. The blacklisting will not harm Ansarullah as it did not harm Hezbollah and all other free people in the world. Rather, it may harm ordinary Yemenis only. We reject this decision and refuse to call the Ansarullah movement a terrorist group.
Yemenis are concerned that the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement may impact the humanitarian situation in Yemen amid the ongoing war that was launched by the Saudi-led coalition in March 2015. The devastating war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and injured thousands of others in Yemen, while displacing millions in the country. Yemenis say the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement is an unacceptable move, prompted by the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They say the move is aimed at putting more pressure on Yemen, already in dire situation from war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
French President Emmanuel Macron has refused an official apology for colonial-era abuses in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be, quote, no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the bloody eight-year war that ended French rule there. The presidency also said the French leader would instead take part in symbolic acts aimed at promoting reconciliation. The statement came ahead of the publication of a major report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. During Algeria's independence war against the colonial ruler, more than 1.5 million Algerians were killed. France has already acknowledged that it was responsible for systematic torture during the war. Meanwhile, a global coalition of Muslim organizations have submitted a formal complaint to the UN Human Rights Council demanding immediate legal action against France over the violation of its Muslim citizens' rights. Robert Carter has more in this report.
Amid deepening concerns over state-backed French Islamophobia, a global coalition of Muslim NGOs has teamed up to take on the government. 36 Muslim organizations from 13 countries have submitted a joint complaint to the UN Human Rights Council, urging them to take action against France's increasingly hostile policies. The UK-based Muslim Public Affairs Committee was one of the groups that signed the complaint.
What Macron is doing is weaponizing secularism, that is to say, French secularism in particular, for his Islamophobic agenda. And he's justifying this by stating that French Muslims are essentially causing separatism, when in reality he's framing this, all the policies all are very the epitome of trying to frame it as a Muslim problem, in the very similar way that Hitler did with the Jews, and tried to frame all the ills of what's happening in Germany as a Jewish problem.
Tensions between the French President Emmanuel Macron and the Muslim world has been at an all-time high since last year, when Macron introduced new legislation targeting so-called Islamic extremism and defending deeply offensive caricatures insulting Islam's holy prophet. The caricatures led to furious worldwide protests, while the anti-Islamism laws paved way for a local crackdown, which saw 76 mosques forced to close, the country's biggest Muslim charity and an anti-Islamophobia organization banned, dozens arrested, and hundreds of planned deportations. In October, the founder of Baraka City, Idriss Si Hamedi, experienced firsthand France's new approach, after his home was violently raided by riot police after he condemned Islamophobic government ministers and an anti-Islam activist on Twitter.
For example, if they sent me a message, strong message, with the special forces, they closed my organization, they closed the CCIF, they closed the mosque, they closed a lot of organizations. So the Muslims around Baraka City and another organization like that, they will be afraid. It's very complicated to explain you, to share you the feeling of the Muslim community. But with beard or without beard, you have problem. With hijab or without hijab, you have a problem. Now, the target, the mind of the Muslim community.
The passionate street protests may have stopped for now, but the Muslim response to Macron's anti-Islam policies hasn't finished yet. With an additional complaint due to be sent to the European Union later this year, with the hopes of forcing Macron into a U-turn on these policies. Robert Carter, London.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The storming of the U.S. Capitol has global repercussions. Not least among them is the weakening of the self-serving definition of democracy, especially when it comes to justifying war, says Ramsey Baru, journalist, in an article titled, "By Force and Fraud, Is This the End of the U.S. Democracy Doctrine?" Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. In an interview with the British newspaper The Times in 2015, former U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld vehemently denied that exporting democracy to Iraq was the main motive behind the U.S. invasion of that country 12 years earlier. Rumsfeld further alleged that the idea that we could fashion a democracy in Iraq seemed to me unrealistic. But the U.S. top military chief was being dishonest. Writing in Mother Jones, Miles E. Johnson responded to Rumsfeld's claim by quoting some of his previous statements where he repeatedly cited democracy as the main reason behind the U.S. invasion of war that was one of the most destructive since Vietnam. Certainly, it was not Rumsfeld alone who brazenly promoted the democracy pretense. Indeed, democracy was the buzzword parroted by thousands of Americans in government, the military, mainstream media, and the numerous think tanks that dotted the intellectual and political landscape of Washington. American linguist and historian Noam Chomsky has long argued that the United States is not a democracy, but a plutocracy, a country that is governed by the interests of the powerful few. He also argued that while the U.S. does operate based on formal democratic structures, these are largely dysfunctional. In an interview with Global Policy Journal in 2019, Chomsky further asserted that the U.S. Constitution was framed to thwart the democratic aspirations of most of the public. This has been evident for many years. Long before Trump became president, the dichotomy of American democracy has expressed itself in the way that the American people interact with their supposedly democratic institutions. For example, merely 20% of U.S. adults trust their government, according to a Pew Research Center poll published last September. This number has remained relatively unchanged under previous administrations. With the U.S. economy rapidly sinking due to various factors, including the government's mishandling of the COVID-19 pandemic, the people's distrust in government is now manifesting itself in new ways, including mass violence. The fact that 77% of those who voted for Trump in the November elections believe that Joe Biden's win was due to fraud suggests that a sizable percentage of Americans have little faith in their country's democracy. The consequences of this realization will surely be dire. America's constitutional crisis, which is unlikely to be resolved in the current atmosphere of polarization, is compounded by an external political crisis. One could not help but reflect on the subject when, on January 6th, thousands of Americans stormed the Washington Plaza, climbing the walls of Capitol Hill, and taken over the U.S. Congress, a country that has assisted itself the role of the defender of democracy worldwide, now stands unable to defend its own democracy at home. In the case of Iraq, as soon as U.S. troops stormed into Baghdad, they hurriedly occupied all government buildings and every symbol of Iraqi sovereignty. Triumphant troops were filmed rampaging through the offices of former Iraqi ministers, smoking their cigars while placing their dirty boots on the top of the desks. Bizarrely, similar scenes were repeated in Washington 17 years later, this time in the offices of top U.S. legislators, including the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. In Iraq, from March 2003, ministers were hunted down as their photos and names were circulated through what the U.S. military referred to as Iraq's most wanted deck of cards. In the American scenario, U.S. Congress women and women were forced to cower their desks or to run for their lives. The violent events in Washington have been depicted by U.S. mainstream media as if a temporary crisis instigated by a president who refuses to concede to power peacefully and democratically. The truth, however, is far more complex. There is nothing transitory about any of this, and while Donald Trump is largely to blame for the bloody events of that day, the man is a symptom of America's rooted democracy crisis, which is likely to worsen in the future. Historically, the United States has defined and redefined its mission in the world based on lofty spiritual, moral, and political maxims, starting with Manifest Destiny to fighting communism to eventually serving as the defender of human rights and democracy around the world. The latter was merely a pretense used to provide a moral cover that would allow the U.S. to reorder the world for the sake of expanding its market and ensuring its economic dominance. Thomas Paine, whose influence on U.S. ideals of liberty and democracy is arguably unmatched, warned, in Common Sense in 1776, against the potential tyranny of those who attempt to govern mankind by force and fraud as if they were all knaves and fools. Alas, Paine's warning went unheeded. Indeed, the democracy fraud that Rumsfeld, George W. Bush, et al. Carried out in Iraq in 2003 was a mere repetition of numerous other fraudulent military campaigns carried out around the world. The so-called protectors of democracy became the very men responsible for its undoing. Unquestionably, the storming of U.S. Congress will have global repercussions, not least among them the weakening of U.S. hegemonic and self-serving definition of what constitutes a democracy. Is it possible that the U.S. democracy doctrine could soon cease to be relevant in the lexicon of U.S. foreign policy conduct, one that is predicted per Paine's logic on force and fraud?
Food for thought. Hello, dear friends, and here is a famous statement to reflect upon regarding the pride of place amongst women of the Prophet's virtuous daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, as narrated by her great-great-grandson, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Fatima was called Muhaddasa because the angels descended from heaven and called her, as they called Mary, mother of Jesus, and said, O Fatima, Allah hath chosen you above the women of all nations.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zaid As-Salam.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio and another program for humanity where we are discussing the treatise of rights of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. We have reached up to the right number 37, which is the right of the adversary. In the Arabic word, the word khasm has been used. And khasm is someone who has an issue with you, or someone who has a claim. And this claim could be a claim that they might have against you, or it could be a claim that you might have against somebody else. And that pretty much means that the word khasm or adversary is going to be taken in two ways. And this is exactly how Imam Zain al-Abidin, peace be upon him, describes it. In the first section, he speaks about the adversary of someone who has a claim against you. And then he goes into speaking about the rights of the adversary against whom you have a claim. And in both cases, we need to initially understand that in the nature of our living as human beings, with interacting with other people, we are going to have times where we will be confrontational, where we will have an issue, we will have a disagreement, a misunderstanding. And unfortunately, it could lead to major conflict and problems. The reason being is, as human beings, it's within our nature that we want to seek that which benefits us, and we want to avoid or repel or distance ourselves away from that which is going to be detrimental or damaging to us. And that's going to mean that we will have to kind of stand up for our rights and defend ourselves. And on this basis, we know that when it comes to our religion, Islam, in Islam, it educates us from the outset of how one is able to engage with the rest of people in society. Seeing that it is our nature to want to live with the rest of civilization, we need to have a clear understanding of how we must conduct ourselves should there be a time of conflict. And this is all for the sake of making sure that the human soul does not go beyond what it is that it has as far as its rights and recommendations are concerned. It's on this basis that we see that the educational school of Islam has engaged human in learning and studying and educating themselves. And this is for the purpose of the soul elevating itself and making sure that we do not form a chaotic society, or we do not pursue the interests at the harm and damage of other people, leading us towards very negative vices like greed and transgression of rights. Just going to go for a short break, and we will be back very, very soon.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back again, dear listeners. And we were speaking about making sure that we don't transgress the rights of other people. When we understand what adversary means and what conflict means, then implementing Islam in the correct way will enable us to eliminate all of these issues of conflict. And conflict will, of course, bring about a lot of very bad and dangerous things in society. It means that there's going to be things that we don't want in a society, whether it be greed, whether it be bitterness among people, whether it be the unrealistic requirements that one might pursue, whether it be the destruction of other people's properties or things like that. It might even affect a relationship that one might have as well. And therefore, we need to make sure that we uphold ourselves in the highest level of ethical recommendations, and we prevent ourselves from falling into any kind of conflict. With Islam making that claim that it is all comprehensive in all of its elements and all of its dimensions, this incident of a conflict that could appear in one's life needs to be solved. And this is why it is going to be very, very important for us to understand how we are able to solve these issues, or resolution, conflict resolution plans. And in, alhamdulillah, in fiqh, in our jurisprudence, there is a special place for the issues related to the judiciary system in Islam, and arbitrating, and issues to do with conflict and adversary and everything else regarding that. And that's why Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, he says that one of the most critical positions is the position of a judge, a qadi. And he says, Al-Qudatu Arba. There are four kinds of judges. Three of them are in hell and one will be in heaven. The first one who will be in hell is a judge who judges with tyranny and oppression. And he knows that he is judging with tyranny and oppression. A second is a judge who judges and they don't know what they are judging about. Like without knowledge, with ignorance, they will be in hell. And a judge who judges with the right way, but they don't know what it is that they are judging as well. And then there is the judge who is judging rightfully and they are doing so with knowledge. That kind of person will be in heaven. According to this kind of hadith and other hadiths similar to this, there are two very, very important points that lay down as the foundation for issues to do with adversaries or to do with conflict or to do with conflict resolution or judging or anything else like that. And the first is the importance of judging in the legal Shari'i system of Islam, and the second is the qualities of the judge and who a person who is able to solve an adversary issue needs to have. What are their qualities? We're going to continue on with speaking about this until our next program. Please visit us on parstoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Other figures providing the Bahraini regime with their services is Field Marshal Peter Ng, now Baron Ng. After his retirement from the army in 1997, Ng became a paid advisor to King Hamad of Bahrain in 2004. Although the nature of his service is yet to be revealed, Ng was advising King Hamad during and after the regime's crackdown on the 2011 pro-democracy protests. Ng was then a shareholder in the private military corporation Aegis Defense Services, which had an office in Manama at the time. The truth is, many of these pro-Bahraini British figures have interests in arms corporations that sell their products to Manama. Lord Peter Ricketts, who was once accompanying David Cameron as National Security Advisor in Bahrain, is another case in point. He is now a strategic advisor to the CEO of Lockheed Martin UK. In 2018, Manama signed a $1.1 billion contract with Lockheed Martin to make F-16 fighter jets for its Air Force. Another figure close to the Bahraini throne is Rupert Goodman, the director of Lord Richard's company, Equilibrium Global. Goodman has written an extremely positive book about King Hamad, titled Two Decades of Leadership.
The relationship between the British government and the Bahrain is very, very long. I mean, I think the two governments, or rather Bahrain, has been associated with Great Britain for all 200 years, and the British see it as a colonial extension of its past empire. And in that time, these arrangements or these links, which are profitable for both sides, have grown up almost naturally. I mean, it's the corruption of colonial development. I mean, so there's very little to be surprised about these links.
Britain has also developed a wide range of programs to boost Bahrain's internal security. Dozens of Bahraini military leaders, including senior members of the royal family, are graduates of British military academies. Prince Nasser bin Hamad, also a graduate of Sandhurst Military Academy, is known inside Bahrain as Torture Prince for his role in the torture of political activists who participated in the 2011 uprising. As the head of Bahrain's Olympic Committee, he formed a special commission to identify and punish more than 150 professional athletes who took part in the protests. The regime's major internal security institutions are also trained by their British counterparts, including the Royal Guard, the Ministry of Interior, the police, and the prison service. Whereas the full extent of British training is unclear, it involves techniques useful in countering protests, like the use of water cannon and dog handling. Bahrain's Royal Guard's Rapid Intervention Force is among the Bahraini military units with close ties with British forces. It has been under fire for taking part in the bloody war in Yemen in 2015. In the international arena, the British government has always helped the Bahraini regime rehabilitate its image for its appalling human rights record. In 2017, London did not back a joint UN statement condemning Manama for its poor human rights record. Surprisingly enough, the British government argued that the statement did not recognize some of the genuine progress Bahrain has made. A year earlier, as The Guardian revealed, Britain had been involved in a secret lobbying campaign in the UN for Bahrain. There are many cases of human rights violation in Bahrain, especially after the 2011 protests. In two more recent cases in 2018, Bahraini activist Nabil Rajab was handed down a 5-year prison sentence for just posting critical tweets, and Ali Salman, the former Secretary General of the Al-Wafaq Party, received a life sentence for the trumped-up charge of spying for Qatar, a ruling Amnesty International described as a travesty of justice that demonstrates the Bahraini authorities' relentless and unlawful efforts to silence any form of dissent.
I don't think they care very much about the You know, I mean, the White Stallion went off to the prince just about the same time as Amnesty International condemned Bahraini suppression of the Shiite majority in that place, in that country. So I think it's not an issue for them.
The British establishment offers its support to Bahrain through yet more subtle outlets, like the Bahrain Society. Based in the UK, the organization is chaired by former British military officer Brigadier Peter Sincock, who has personally worked with King Hamad since 1968. In the words of Sincock, "I worked closely with the then Crown Prince, now King Hamad, and had much to do with the formation of the embryo Bahrain Defense Force." Manama Dialogue is just another forum for the same PR exercises in favor of the Bahraini regime. It is a high-level annual conference on international affairs held in Bahrain's capital city since 2004. The organizer is the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS. The institute is mainly funded by arms corporations like BAE Systems, Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, as well as the British Army and the UK and Bahraini governments, among others. According to a memorandum of understanding between the forum and Bahrain, the IISS will have contact with the offices of King Hamad and will continue to work closely with the Minister of Foreign Affairs and other Bahraini government ministers.
There's the connections between not only a certain segment of the upper classes, which would find itself into these organizations, but also the royal family is close with Bahrain. I mean, the Queen allegedly, well, is reported to have given the Bahraini prince a white stallion. And this was just a couple of years ago, and it was, you know, not too long before the crackdown of the Shiite majority.
No doubt whatever is known about the UK-Bahrain relations is just the tip of the iceberg, the full extent of which is not clear yet. For example, what roles have the Queen and the Palace played over the past decades in keeping the Al Khalifa regime in power? Or what concessions the Bahraini Kingdom has made in return? Who knows?
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to reports, over 25,000 uniformed American terrorists, much more than the number of CENTCOM terrorists in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and the Persian Gulf region combined, have turned Washington, especially the area around the Capitol Hill and the White House, into a military barracks for inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading "Heart of International Terrorism in Fear of Infighting Among Local Terrorists." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. after long decades of disturbing the peace of world countries, destabilizing towns and cities, destroying the heritage of humanity, and decimating millions of people around the globe, the trigger-happy terrorists are finally being stationed where they ought to be. According to reports, over 25,000 uniformed American terrorists, much more than the number of CENTCOM terrorists in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and the Persian Gulf region combined, have turned Washington, especially the area around the Capitol Hill and the White House, into a military barracks for inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden and the formal kicking out of the defeated incumbent Donald Trump. It means the heart of international terrorism is trembling with a fear at the prospects of far greater violence and possible gunfights on January 20th, following the storming of the Congress headquarters a fortnight ago by armed gangs incited by Trump. It is against the principal policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran to interfere in the internal matters of other countries. Nor are we in a position to judge the fairness of the American presidential elections. And neither we can foretell whether the Republican rogue, who for the past 4 years terrorized the world, would be acquitted or convicted of crimes committed in the U.S., not outside, where American presidents are free to do anything. Of course, we will be glad to see the terrorist Trump in handcuffs. We will also explore every avenue to see he and his accomplices get the deserving punishment for their unpardonable crime of killing the anti-terrorist icons, Iran's General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. Besides depriving Iran of over $300 billion of revenues by intimidating other countries with sanctions for doing business with the Islamic Republic. As for the fears of gunfights and possible deaths in Washington and all over the U.S. on January 20th, although we condemn acts of violence anywhere in the world and we have profound sympathies for the ordinary American citizens, it is not our concern whether the Democrats use uniformed terrorists to crush Trump's fully armed supporters or the Republicans succeed in splitting army ranks to make troops go at each other's throats. Anything can happen in the next few days in the U.S., where the jittery FBI has warned of the potential for armed protests and bitter infighting in Washington and at all 50 state capitol buildings ahead of Joe Biden's inauguration. And when this happens, to the relief of the free world, then the Americans should realize that history's most evil empire is in full spiral towards its impending doom, which means the birth of a new era in the northern part of the New World.